Book of Ruth. I am super excited. I am just loving what we're doing, especially when you begin to understand the connectivity and the way that the Book of Ruth fits into this Christmas season. A lot of times, you know, we think of certain things and we're used to certain perspectives during the Christmas season, but I am loving what we're learning with the Book of Ruth and all that's taking place. It was really neat this week when I asked Julia. Julia did a great job reading. I love hearing the whole first chapter of Ruth being read publicly. But even as we were talking and we were, you know, kind of bantering back and forth, it was funny because she goes, "Oh yeah, that would be great. And yeah, that would be great. It's my favorite Cinderella story." And I'm, you know, as a guy, you know, I've studied the Book of Ruth and read through it, but I was just kind of like, oh, Cinderella story. You know, it was like, okay, let me look at it that way. Just because as a man, I'd never read the Book of Ruth and be like, oh my word, that's just great. But I do understand, and I agree with her. I think it's beautiful. Just as a man, I'd never looked at it through those eyes. Now, as we're jumping in, I want to say that Ruth, we've titled this series, Hope Out of the Darkness. Hope Out of Darkness. And so when we think about what we're going through with Judges, and even what Pastor Chris just said, that if you take the timeline of the Judges, you can take the Book of Ruth and you can insert it, because as you read in the first verses we already just read this morning, you can see that somewhere in there, and there's different scholars that believe there's different time frames for where it fits in there, but this is an example for us of hope out of darkness. Now, the title this morning, and I think you'll understand, you're going to have to hang with me because somebody said after the last service, "Tim, you gave a lot of details." And I'm like, so I'm going to do the same thing this morning. But I think it's going to be helpful because for me, I've learned a lot the last couple weeks. I was familiar with a couple things, but I had no idea of the maze of the customs and the technicalities that we just kind of read past with Western eyes. We don't see those things as we naturally read through the Book of Ruth. And so this morning, as we address these things, we're going to pursue the Book of Ruth from a perspective of, like I said, in the middle of Judges. So if you think about, let me just read what we talked about last week, Judges 21:25. "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And if we believe that these events in the Book of Ruth take place during the time of the Judges, it was a time of moral and spiritual decadence. The people of Israel had rejected Yahweh as king, and they were longing for a physical king. And the reason that they were longing for a physical king is that they had been so corrupted and influenced by all the pagan gods. Think about this, that throughout the Book of Judges, you see this group of people saying, "No, God, we don't want you, the creator of the universe, to be our king. We want to be like everybody else, and we want an earthly king." And so this is what the scene is, and this is kind of what's going on. And as only God can orchestrate, the king was on his way. But it was much deeper and more complicated than what would transpire under Samuel. This is what I love. If you can go a little bit deeper and look at some of the nuances of what's going on here, the people were yearning for a physical king just to be like everybody else. Well, not just with what was going to read in the Book of Samuel. God was sending a king, but Ruth is a record of the lineage of Messiah, the King of Kings. And I just want to say, as non-Israelites, and I don't know if any of you in here are of the household of Israel, if you are Jewish born, most of us are not. We're non-Israelites, so we're Gentiles. And so for those of us that are Gentiles, we should take special exception and appreciation to the Book of Ruth because of what's highlighted here, involving someone who comes to faith from the background of being Moabite. Out of the spiritual cesspool that Israel has become, there were still Israelites who, in the middle of all that, they were true to Yahweh. Their faith and love influenced a foreigner to forsake her pagan beliefs to pursue the God of Israel. Now, I want to mention that one team of scholars says that the four chapters of Ruth represent four acts of a drama of loyalty and redemption. The four chapters also address four views of history common in the ancient world as well as our current world. This morning, I want to share Act 1 or Chapter 1. And just as we've been studying the book of Judges, it's funny how Chapter 1, it has the history as a cycle of repeating itself again and again. And we've been talking about this. We've discussed the cycle of sin, judgment, consequences, deliverance, and peace throughout our study of Judges. Ruth Chapter 1 gives a full circle overview as Naomi journeys with her husband and boys to Moab from Bethlehem, only to return to Bethlehem from Moab with only her Moabite daughter-in-law. She seems to be to have very little to show for her long-term investment in Moab. And if Ruth Chapter 1 was the end of the book, if you only had Ruth Chapter 1, it would look just like the book of Judges. Even the way that she proclaims and what she says, if you were to just take Ruth Chapter 1, you'd be like, okay, that looks just like Judges. Now, what I want to do is I want to show you something up here. I want you to check this out because I want to give you a good idea, because a lot of times when we read, we don't necessarily have a good understanding of what we're talking about. So when Naomi and Elimelech left, you can see that if you look down here at the bottom, it wasn't just like they took a two-hour walk when they decided to leave Bethlehem and go to Moab. And then when you think about when she took that first journey, she was with her man. And this is a male culture, protection, provision. On the return trip, she's coming all the way back with just her daughter-in-law. So just think about that. Now, I want to remind us this morning that the Bible, please hear me, because I think that some of us need a regular reminder of this. The Bible is not an English creation. The original manuscripts are not in English. It was penned with the not, and it was not penned with the customs of the Western world. The Bible is cross-cultural, with many traditions, please hear me, having their roots in the Eastern world. Sometimes we must make a conscious effort to consider ways of life that seem totally foreign to everything that we have experienced in our part of the world. Think about this. Just because we read something that doesn't match what we see life through here, now we've got multiple people in here that have traveled to the East, some of you military, other different places. When you've traveled outside the country and you've seen other ways of living, it's helpful because then you begin to see through a different lens. You find out that there's another way, that there are people that have different marriage arrangements that can be happy and they can work things out, but we naturally see things through the lens of our experience. I can remember my daughter, Megan. I can pick on her because she's away at school right now. So I can remember when she made a commitment in her life. She started studying the Bible when she was in middle school and began to really press into Scripture. I can remember times where she'd come to me and she'd be like, Dad, because all she saw was her lens was Western through what she'd experienced with us. And she'd read some of these horrific things or see some of these events in the Old Testament. And she'd like, I got a problem with this. When I'm reading this, I don't like men. And I'm like, I get you. I understand. And it was good because then we'd sit down, we'd have conversation, we'd have discussions, and she would have to work through because she saw the Bible through her English Western lens. And so anything outside of that. Now that she's traveled outside the United States, she has a totally different lens. She sees things differently. So I want to remind you as we're jumping into this, don't be narrow-minded about what we need to learn this morning so that we can understand the depths and the gravity of God's miraculous provision in this story. It's important to highlight the maze of customs and technicalities that you may not notice as you just navigate this seeming love story. So let's jump in. We're going to go real quick. I got several things I want to give you because we're talking about customs and technicalities. First one I want to mention is gleaning, okay? Gleaning. I'll give you Leviticus 19, 9 through 10. You can look some of these up while we're talking. We can go through. Gleaning was the process of going back over a field, orchard, or vineyard after the main harvest had taken place. This was done separately to gather every last bit of the crop or produce. The law, please hear me, some of you that have read Ruth already, and you think that Boaz is just being a nice guy? No, Boaz was keeping the law because there were laws in place. The law prohibited the landowners from gleaning their lands. This was done to provide the poor with the privilege of gathering whatever the harvesters had missed or left behind. Ruth chapter 2 reveals that Boaz was a just man because he was committed to following the law. So let's take it like this, okay? David, you just did a field of corn this year, right? Okay, so the guys that you had harvesting. So typically for production and time investment, okay, it goes through the field and you got the big combine and the corn's being harvested. Typically in our culture, because of time investment and return, you don't see people out in the fields walking behind these big combines picking up because it doesn't get everything, correct? There's still stuff left in the field. Well, in the same way, think about, and this is important to the story, because in the same way, the first wave of people that were going through harvesting, whether it was in a vineyard, whether it was in a field, they wouldn't get everything, but then the landowners were not allowed to go back through and send the people back through again, that whatever was missed the first time laid there, and then later on, the people that were in poverty or struggling, they had the privilege of coming back through and gleaning so that they could provide for their families. This was in the law. This was one of those things that was in place as a landowner. Now, I want to jump from there to the law of redeeming relative, or it's also known as the law of the kinsman redeemer. Leviticus chapter 25, verses 23 through 55. Once the promised land was apportioned to the tribes of Israel, so think about when they came from Egypt, and then they had all these battles, and they conquered the land, and it would be like, okay, I've been homeless, and I haven't had any property for generations. So now, okay, the Broyles family gets Madison County. Okay? The Stelges family gets Albemarle County. And, you know, let's just say the Dean family gets, what's left? Green. Yeah, you get Green County. Stuart's like, I'll trade for, no. Don't give me that. But you think about, when you've been like that, and all of a sudden your tribe is given this amount of land, then this is a big deal. And it's different than us, because sometimes you'll have farms here, two and three generations, then somebody's like, man, land prices are up, so, man, we're going to turn some serious cash, and then it's gone. This was a different situation, because once you got land, understand you had a tribe. You had a group of people. The land provided the place for livestock. The land provided a place for a safe dwelling. The land, it's one of the reasons why they had huge families, because your tribe basically became your community. It became your town. It became your county. And so then that land became super, super important. Do you understand what I'm saying? It was different for them back then. So with that in mind, the law provided, but well, let me just say, but sometimes land could be lost for various reasons. Just because you had land doesn't mean that you're going to be a good steward or manager of it. So sometimes you lost the land for reasons like poverty. The law provided for this problem, please hear this, by giving family members, especially the males, the right and responsibility to repurchase family lands. Thus, the right would fall to the nearest relative of the one who sold the land. The closest relative was referred to as the redeeming relative or kinsman redeemer. Naomi had sold the family's land. We don't know exactly why, but it seems that makes sense that it was to support herself and Ruth. The impact of this law on the process is seen in chapters 2, 3, and 4. You can see bits of that. Boaz was not the first relative in line from Elimelech. The process of the law had to be honored. So I want you to understand this law of the kinsman redeemer had to do with the had to do with the property, the land, and the next relative being able to come back. Now, please understand. Don't misunderstand. This was not a cheap proposition. You didn't just walk in and just get the land back because you were the next one. You had to purchase it again. There was a steep price to pay. Just because the land had been lost and you had an avenue to be able to repurchase it didn't mean that it was inexpensive or you got a deal on it. Now, with that, what I want to jump into is the law of inheritance. We're going to use Numbers chapter 27 along with multiple passages about birthright. So when we're talking about inheritance, you also need to study and look at the aspect of birthright. Ownership of the land in Israel was determined through the male heirs. There are exceptions to this in certain situations where it would be passed on to the ladies. But most of the time it was determined through the male heirs. Elimelech had no male heirs. So when Naomi sold the family's land, she was effectively selling the family inheritance. Unless a redeeming relative purchased land, it would be lost as an inheritance to be passed on. The only option other than the kinsman redeemer would be the year of Jubilee. Now, I'm not going to get into that, but you may want to write down Leviticus chapter 25, 8 through 17, because there was a caveat in the laws. In other words, there was a certain period that during the year of Jubilee, things could be changed and exacted and rearranged, but you'll have to look into this. This is where the maze gets interconnected. The law of inheritance was not just straightforward regarding the land. Please hear me. The unnamed relative was interested in the land until he realized he was interested in the law of inheritance until he realized that he also had to take Ruth as a wife. Any children would actually be considered the sons of Ruth's husband, so that child would receive the inheritance. In fact, it could potentially ruin his own family's inheritance by the high price to redeem. Then he would never able to be the legal possessor of the property. Now, hopefully this will make a little bit more sense, because we're going to jump into the law of the levirate marriage. Now, the reason I use the word maze, I could also use the word spider web, because you're going to see as we get into these things that they're separate laws, but they have these tentacles, these interconnecting pieces. So what I want you to understand is where you might read Ruth and just a cursory and think, oh, this is really cool, there's a lot of amazing hoops and technicalities. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that we're not typically aware of. So let's jump into the law of levirate marriage. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 through 10 is what I'll use. You can go and read that. Think about this, because this is different for us. The law of levirate marriage is foreign to us as Westerners. When a man died without leaving any sons, it created problems. In a male-focused society, it created problems. First, it endangered the family's inheritance, obviously. But if the widow remarried outside the family, the inheritance would go to her new family. So there were technicalities with this process. Second, the widow would have no males to support and protect her, which is a big deal, and it's still that way in many cultures in our world today. The law addressed these issues through a practice called the levirate marriage. If a man died without leaving any children, the man's brother or nearest male relative was to marry the man's widow and father an heir. The child would be considered the child of the deceased man, not the child of the biological father. So let me give you an example. My wife and I, we get married. I don't have a brother, but in this situation, I have a brother. And let's just say he's younger than me. We get married. We don't have any children. Something happens to me. Then he takes my wife. They bear a child. And then that son now becomes my heir, not my brother's heir. So then the inheritance, the property, anything that would have flown through me, the brother biologically fathered the child, but he gets no credit for the child because then that child now represents my line. See, this is new information for a lot of us because this is not what we do in the Western world. So when we read this story, you need to understand some of the technicalities and details that are in play because it genuinely affects how you view God's miraculous intervention in this story. The impact of the levirate marriage was the deal breaker for the unnamed redeeming relative. Once he realized that Ruth and providing an heir were part of the package, he declined because of the impact of his already established family. You can see the deep long-term financial impact on Boaz for honoring both the levirate marriage as well as becoming the kinsman redeemer. Just so you understand, Boaz, he paid a steep price for this situation. And as we're going to read later on, the child is considered whose? Naomi's. So these are technicalities and these are customs that we need to be aware of. Now, I'm going to take a simpler one for just a second. I just want to mention the elders at the gate. I'll give you Deuteronomy 25, 7, Judges 5, 8, and 11, 2 Samuel 19, 8. But I just want to mention this because a lot of you are beginning to study the scripture. And a lot of times when you read the Old Testament, you'll see or you'll mention even in the New Testament that there's a lot of things taking place at the gates. Okay, what's all the meeting at the gates about? All right, what that is in the ancient world, the city gates were customarily the setting for civic and economic deliberations. The area of the city gates functioned much like our courts, our court buildings, our city halls, and our municipal buildings in our current world. So you tracking with me? Because it's important. But later on we get, it's like, you know, what takes place when Ruth goes to Boaz and he's like, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, that's why he shot to the city gates. It's like, let's go get business taken care of, okay? That's where you get business taken care of. So next one, betrothal. Let's talk about betrothal. I'll use Luke chapter 1, verse 27. There's so many multiple examples in scripture, especially Jewish historical records. And let me just say this, that betrothal does not have the same meaning as a Western term as to what it means here. Betrothal in this time was a formal agreement between a man and a woman with legal and religious aspects, except, please hear me, actual cohabitation. Betrothal then did not mean being cohabitation together. We must also consider, I'm just going to throw this out because this is part of this culture, we've got to consider dowry and bride price. Genesis 29 and 31, you got the example of Jacob. And this practice is still active in many Eastern nations, many nations around the world. Okay? So it's like, you know, hey, she's worth 12 camels. No, she's worth 150 camels. Anyway. That was a joke, by the way. I know some of you are in information overload. You're like, oh my word, all I want to do is read the book of Ruth. Okay? Well, this will help. So this is an important detail as there was a private, please hear this. This is super important about the betrothal. I believe that there was a private transaction that took place between Boaz and Ruth prior to the meeting with the elders at the gates. At the advice and understanding of her mother-in-law, Naomi was a smart woman. She understood the laws and the technicalities because she was Jewish. Ruth goes to Boaz and basically asks him to be her kinsman redeemer. Now, me personally, when I read the narrative, I personally believe that Boaz was a single older man. I believe that he was a shrewd man. I believe that he was wealthy. He was successful. I believe he had his stuff together. And I believe that he was an honorable man of integrity. I believe that he naturally would have expected Ruth to choose a younger man. It just makes sense. If you read the narrative, he noticed her in the field. He noticed a lot of things about her, but he noticed her in the field. That's some gleaning going on over there. You with me? Somebody need to pull your head up when you read the Bible. And it's like, no, it's real life. You know, it's like Boaz like, wow, she's got great work ethic. No, well, she did have great work ethic. It appears that Ruth was unaware of the unnamed relative. So when Ruth goes to Boaz and presents herself, and we'll cover this more, but I want you to understand the betrothal process. Boaz informs her that the relative was first in line. So when we're talking about inheritance, the levirate marriage, and we're talking about all these other things, I don't believe that Ruth was aware of that. So when she goes to him, he's like, whoa, hey, I got to be honest with you. You need to understand that there's somebody that's next in line. So we're going to have to address this. We're going to have to get this taken care of. Ruth's words about Boaz taking her under his wing are interesting as it appears that they are words of betrothal. During the actual marriage ceremony, it was customary for the groom's relatives that they would cover the bride with the groom's garment, indicating that then on, from that point on, she was under his protection. So I want you to just think about this, because I don't want you to misread this. So when Naomi tells Ruth to go and present herself, it was beautiful. Hey, I need you to get dolled up, look your best, smell good. you know what I'm saying. And so, but please understand, when you read the context, it's not a sexual presentation. She's going to him, and when she lays at his foot, she is being very proper, but she's at the same time being very forward, that I'm giving myself to you, and I want you to be my kinsman redeemer. I want us to be betrothed. I want you to be my husband. When Boaz wakes up, no misunderstanding. Whoa! And if you look at the steps he took steps of integrity to protect her integrity, because there was nothing unlawful out of character that had been done. We just don't understand this process because we don't understand betrothal, and because we don't understand waiting in certain ways for certain things to take place in accordance to what the legal system was back then. Now, with that in mind, I want you to just consider the law of the sojourner versus the natural law of prejudice. Now, if you look at Leviticus and Deuteronomy, there's so much about this, but you need to understand this, because this is a very important component when you were studying the book of Ruth. And please hear me when I say this. I am learning a ton. A couple of these things I was aware of, I had no idea of the depth of the legal constraints, the legal technicalities, all the customs that were a part of this story. So if you learn some things, or if you learn some new things, and I don't claim to be an expert, but oh my word, it is blowing my mind as I'm learning some of these new things. The law of the sojourner, the law of the foreigner versus the natural law of prejudice. So understand, under the law, Ruth, as a foreigner, was entitled to numerous privileges as a foreigner or a sojourner. You can use either one of those words. There were actually legal provisions in place for her protection and care, but that did not mean that there was not a level of prejudice regarding her origins. So think of it this way. One side of the coin, you've got these laws of protection because you're a foreigner. The other side of the coin, we hate Moabites. Ethnic prejudice. So Ruth was not just a foreigner, but she was a foreigner from Moab. She was a Moabite. Let me read you this. Deuteronomy 23, 3 through 8 states that Ammonites and Moabites were to be excluded from the assembly of the Lord. Numbers chapter 22 through 25 and chapter 31 through 15 and 16 reveal why the children of Israel had such a negative history with the Moabites. They had good reasons to not trust these people, to not like them, to not want to associate with them. This group of people was so abhorred by the Jews that they were forbidden to seek their peace or their prosperity. Did you hear what I just said? So just that little bit of information, if you go all the way back to what Julia read in chapter 1, doesn't that give you a different perspective on Naomi blessing her Moabite daughter-in-laws before she tried to send them away? Because she was actually doing what had been taught not to do, because we have prejudice toward these people. The marriage and the relationship with a family from Bethlehem would be viewed differently in Moab. So you take a family from Israel and they go to Moab. They're among the Moabites. Israeli men, men from Judah, marry Moabite women. That's cool. But then you take that same arrangement and you drop it in the middle of Judah. Not cool. Are you tracking with me? And you see this even today. There might be laws in place, but that doesn't mean that you're protected from hatred and prejudice. Once you realize the maze of customs and technicalities, you begin to understand the desperate situation in Naomi of Ruth. Because you can look and say, oh, things didn't work out. They're coming back to Bethlehem. No, the deck was way more stacked against them in Naomi's mind than what you may realize. It was definitely a dark time, but God was at work to provide a way for them that would extend to us. This is so cool. Now, I got to show you this. You got to look at this because I love the visual here. Now, this is not the greatest picture because I took a picture of this in my Bible. I love this chart. I couldn't find anything close enough to it on the internet. So for those of you who say, Tim, what I did try. But what I want you to look at, and this is so amazing, is when you look up here on the top right-hand side, Salmon, go back and read the story, but Rahab, and then you see Ruth. All the way down. What time of the year are we celebrating? So you remember who Rahab, the harlot, the prostitute? You remember that story and where her part in that? Go back and read that. And you look at Ruth, who was a Moabite, who originally worshiped pagan gods, who then came to faith in Yahweh, in Jehovah. And if this is not invigorating to your spirit, I hope that at some point it will, because it is affecting me deeply about the way that I'm looking at this Christmas season. Because a lot of times we get wrapped up in the season. We talk about Jesus and he's come and the king has come. But this started way, 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 way back. And God's mighty hand of preparation, and just as Julia said earlier, using a woman that was just dealing with today. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I'm looking at today and I'm like, God, I need your help. And he's like, I got you. I got you. I'm like, no, because he doesn't got me the way that my expectation wants him to get me. Are you tracking with me? Like, no. I need your help, but I have a very specific expectation of how I want you to help me. And oh my God, that's not meeting my expectation. And God is not only working here, but God's working in me if I will let him. Because he not only wants to provide for me right here, but he wants to provide for me in amazing ways in months and years to come. When I learn all this stuff, it totally changes the way I view the book of Ruth, and it changes, well, it's gone now. That's cool. It changes the way that I look. Is it back again? Just trying to see if you're going to take it away when I turn around. Oh, that's good. Thank you. Ruth was just trying to be obedient, trying to do what needed to be done, trying to survive the day. No idea that she was going to be one of four women mentioned in the Bible in the line of Jesus. Whoa. God was in the process of sending a king, but not in the way that the people of Israel thought. The Son of God, the King of Kings, was not just for the household of Israel, but it was for the world. A king and a savior for all ethnic groups, to anyone who would believe. A king to rule over the heart and mind of anyone who trusts in his great love, not just in Jerusalem, not just in Bethlehem, but here in Virginia, in Madagascar, in mainland China, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. Global, the king. And I want to say to you this morning, we sing songs, but we can also say this morning, not just that the king has come, but the king is coming. Whatever you think are dark technicalities in your life, you feel like the deck is stacked against you this morning. You feel like that there's this spider web and there's no way out for you. The book of Ruth says, God's got you and he can handle it if you'll let him. The beautiful thing about Ruth, she went from being pagan to being a follower and a believer, and she walked in the ways. Look at the miraculous ways that God navigated all these technicalities that I wasn't even aware of for most of my life. And God did amazing things, and our Savior came through her line. Jesus is not just our King. He's a trustworthy ruler of our lives if we will submit to him. Let's stand and sing together this morning.